Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freundo, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language, and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. All right, Super Ninfriendos, we promised you something special, and here it is. We have Reggie Fils-Aimé here to talk to us about his upcoming book. Very happy to have you, Reggie. I have never spoken to you, and I'm a little nervous, so please forgive me. I'm a little starstruck right now.
No worries. You know, we won't put you through the ringer too badly here.
Okay. I thought you were going to say there's a presence I haven't felt since. Welcome, Reggie.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's been days.
Good book, Reggie. I'm sorry if this ages you a little bit, but I was in college in E3 2004 when you were talking, which you talk about at some length in your book, and that was the first time I was introduced to Reggie Fils-Aimé saying, "I'm here to kick ass, take names, and we're about making video games." And I think it lodged in our collective memory. And so I'm just curious, like, how does it feel to look back on this, like, 15 years at Nintendo?
You know, it's at times completely startling. And it's not only looking back at that press conference, it's looking back to the press conference where we shared the Wii, the press conference where we shared We Fit, and even the more recent activities where we unveiled the Nintendo Switch, to look back on all of these meaningful moments just in the video game space. And then in writing the book, you know, it forced me to think back on some of my other activities, things that maybe aren't as visible as my time at Nintendo, but things that, you know, formulated me, my management approach. So it was quite stunning to look back on my career today.
I thought that was one of the things that I really liked about the book was the kind of prehistory part and how you got to your position at Nintendo. And by the way, good job, Kat, quoting the famous Reggie sentence correctly. I never realized the thought that went into deciding whether to say I'm about making games or we're about making games. And you talk about that at length in the book.
It was a major issue at the time. And you know what people may not realize is when you're gearing up for a big press conference like that, especially my unveiling to the video game press, every word mattered. And as we were going through rehearsals, and I'm closing that initial stanza by saying, I'm about making games, it just became more and more clear that it wasn't ringing true. I mean, imagine you have Shigeru Miyamoto in the audience. You know, you have all of these other Nintendo game creators listening to this. And it's like, you know, that's not right. This, you know, this guy just joined the company. He doesn't write code. He doesn't do anything regarding games. For him to say, I'm about making games, just doesn't fit. So we almost scrapped the entire opening of the video conference. And then, if you will, cooler heads prevailed, and we made a couple pronoun tweaks to frame it as we're about making games, not just we, all of the Nintendo developers, but we are business partners, you know, the big gaming companies, Activision, EA, et cetera, that were part of our press conference. But, you know, what could have been if it would have been just a different opening altogether?
How did you convince Shigeru Miyamoto to have the sword and the shield from The Legend of Zelda and to come out on stage with that?
Well, so Mr. Miyamoto is a showman, and it didn't take much convincing for him to wear, you know, a Zelda shirt and to come out in sword and shield. Didn't take much convincing at all. Just like it didn't take a lot of convincing for in the E3 2006 for him to come out in top hat and tails. So you know, he loves the interaction with fans, with media. You know, obviously he's got a passion for all of the great content he's played a role in. So it was an easy sell. It was probably the easiest sell of my career, getting Mr. Miyamoto to come out and promote Legend of Zelda, what would become Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess.
I thought the kind of the change from your earlier jobs to Nintendo and then kind of bringing out the showman Reggie was really interesting, and you described that so well in the book. Do you feel like in your earlier roles you were obviously working on consumer products that to you being in charge of, you know, the launch of a new pizza type or something were really exciting, but to people reading that now, everybody's like waiting to get to the Nintendo part, but like, do you feel like you were shackled back in those days and working at Nintendo kind of like unleashed the showman, Reggie, or was he always
unleash
there?
The and, Reggie.
Yeah.
Unleash the Reggie.
Were you doing the same thing in the boardroom meetings?
It was always there. And what I would also say is that, you know, like any of us in our professions, it builds over time. So, you know, there needed to be a building over time of confidence in getting up in small group meetings. You know, I talk about in the book, you know, I was hired into a job where so many of my peers were 5 up to 10 years older than I was, because I was hired into this role directly out of undergrad at Cornell University, where all of my peers typically had MBAs and other experiences. So there was a building of confidence to be able to stand up and to provide a point of view. There was a building of confidence to get up in front of, you know, smaller presentation settings of a few hundred people, then a few thousand. So it was a building over time. What I would also say is that it was this magical connection between my own personal capabilities and all of the opportunity of playing that role for Nintendo, to be able to talk about my passions for video games, to talk about what I enjoyed doing, and to bring that to life was just it was a magical moment.
Yeah, and you had a really unlikely journey to the video game industry. Black man from a family of Haitian immigrants, and you went to Ivy League schools, and you're working at places like Procter & Gamble. You're based on the East Coast, whereas video game industry is primarily based on the West Coast. And a lot of your friends were saying, don't do it, Reggie. Don't join the video game industry. What are you doing? Why are you going to Nintendo? But you did it anyway. This kind of unlikely journey to the video game industry is really interesting to me.
You know, the element that I highlight in the book, and it's something that I continue to do today, I believe in looking at the unique path or the alternative outcome, meaning, you know, doing something that isn't expected, exploring paths that are unique and differentiated. And absolutely, at the time that I was considering Nintendo, I had a job offer from another company on the East Coast in a completely different industry. And so it really was a thoughtful, methodical approach of understanding what was the Nintendo opportunity, would I be successful? It certainly fit a passion that I had for the overall video game space and the entertainment space. But all of my close confidants, my mentors at the time, really counseled me not to take the job. It would be far away from family. It was a completely different industry. And again, the industry in 2003, 2004, much smaller than it is today, a bit more insular than it is today. And thank goodness I didn't listen to all those perspectives.
I love your story about Link to the Past. For me personally, too, that was one of those games that, you know, I was in college, I played it, and I can honestly say that's what hooked me, got me back into gaming on the Super Nintendo. And like, it obviously played a huge role in your life as well, that game. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I like it, Pear, how you just aged me, right? I was playing it, as a junior executive, and you were still in school. I played all types of different video games, pinball games in my youth. You know, the earliest of early video games. In college, I gravitated away from video games, played more pinball and other tabletop games. Then I started a family, got away from gaming until I bought a Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And my system came with Super Mario World, played that to full completion, 99 lives, unlocked every single element of that game, and then picked up the controller to play Legend of Zelda Link to the Past. And it truly became a second job to me. I would play in the evenings with my family, then go off. I was working at Pizza Hut at the time, come back home, play again. And it hooked me. It hooked me from the very start, the problem solving aspect of it. And in the book, I highlight that when I got to the final boss in that game, it was, 3 o'clock in the morning. I had to get up and go to work. And decided to put the controller down, decided to get a few hours sleep, and then attack it the next day. And I was playing with my son that entire game, so many of the SNES games. And he had his own save file, but he would always see how far I had gotten before he would start playing on his own save file. And so, that next day, as I'm off at work thinking about the final battle, my son picks up the controller, sees that we're at the final boss, and over the next number of hours tries to beat the game. And he literally beat the game as I was entering the house from a day of work. I could hear him you know, screaming with delight. And as soon as I heard a scream, I knew exactly what happened. And, you know, my biggest personal frustration was that it wouldn't be until I played the game again on virtual console, probably the Wii virtual console, that I finally beat the game and saw the end credits. Because, you know, that back then, you know, it was only the first time that you beat a game that you would see the full end credits. So the fun part of this story is that I told it in front of an audience of gaming executives when Shigeru Miyamoto was being honored by the Electronic Software Association at a big industry dinner. And so I said this with him in the audience and talked about this entire story and how his games touched me. And as I, you know, sit back at the table after he accepts his award, you know, he's seated next to me. He turns to me, he goes, "Reggie-san," and, you know, all of the Nintendo Kyoto employees called me Reggie-san. So, "Reggie-san, is that story true?" It's like, of course it's true. I wouldn't make this up, you know, for this event. "Mr. Miyamoto, this is how you touched me. This is how you touched my family." So just, you know, a wonderful experience even before I was the Reginator as part of Nintendo.
I really liked in the book your story of the first time that you actually met Mr. Miyamoto. Could you go into that a little bit?
Sure. You know, so I joined the company December of 2003, January of 2004, making my first trip to the headquarters. And it's during this trip that we're beginning the prep for E3 2004. So I saw the early art for Twilight Princess. And we were having a discussion around what would become the Nintendo DS. And so imagine, you know, in this conference room, there's a motherboard, two screens soldered onto the motherboard, you know, all of the open guts and electronics of the system. And we're getting an introduction to the touchscreen capabilities, the voice capabilities. And there's probably a group of about 20 of us in a circle with the hardware kind of in the middle. And we're having this this detailed conversation. And you know, I'm the new guy, but I'm expected to make comments and to have a point of view, even though I'm only weeks on the job. And it's because Nintendo of America is the biggest subsidiary of Global Nintendo. So I'm asked a series of questions about the touchscreen, and I'm making comments about how important the touchscreen is. The team starts talking about a game they had in development that would become Nintendogs. And you know, from you know the corner of my eye, I could see that a latecomer has come into the meeting, but I didn't turn around to see exactly who it is. But I'm making all of this commentary about you know how important it's going to be to talk about the touchscreen, how important it is to promote this game in order to fulfill our vision of expanding the universe of players, which is what we were trying to do with Nintendo DS. And then I hear a voice in Japanese making comments. And the translation at Nintendo is Japanese to English. You then respond in English. That's put back into Japanese for the Japanese native speaker to understand what you're saying. So, you know, I hear the Japanese voice, I turn and it's Mr. Miyamoto. And literally my knees begin to shake because I know who he is. This is the first time I'm meeting him. And it was fortunate. You know, he says, you know, these comments are exactly right. You know, we need to focus on the touchscreen. We need to focus on this particular game, we need to focus on communicating all the benefits of the system. And this is being translated back into English. And he finishes his commentary by saying, you know, "Oh, by the way, who are you?" because we had never been introduced at the time. So that was my introduction to Mr. Miyamoto, you know, with that classic ending comment, "Who are you?"
This year, I decided I actually wanted to like follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals. So I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with, like, Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN, it's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. That's nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
You have a few Miyamoto stories, and one of the ones that stood out to me was during the debate over whether or not to pack in Wii Sports with the Wii, and Miyamoto pushed back pretty hard against that. And it was like one of the biggest points of discussion and kind of one of the bigger wins for you.
Yeah, it's an understatement to say that Mr. Miyamoto pushed back. you know, during the development of the Wii and the Wii Sports software, you know, again, the goal was, you know, we wanted this system to be attractive not only to the most active players, but to new players and to bring them into the video gaming experience. And we saw Wii Sports as the way to be able to do that, because each of these sports made great use of the Wii Remote. Each sport was known by a global population, right? People know what golf is, they know what bowling is, they know what baseball is. And, you know, my recommendation was that we pack Wii Sports in with the hardware. And literally, when I first made this suggestion, Mr. Miyamoto said, you know, Reggie, Nintendo does not give away software for free. You don't understand how hard our developers work to create compelling content like this. Now, you know, fortunately, because my SNES came packed in with software, I knew that, in fact, the company has given away software in the past, but it was against a very strategic objective. And that was my commentary back to Mr. Miyamoto, that, you know, by including Wii Sports, we would immediately have value in the hardware as the consumers opening it up and setting it up. But more importantly, we would have a touchstone piece of software that so many consumers would experience. They would talk about it. You know, it's what led to Wii Sports being played in bars, being played on cruise ships, being played in retirement homes. It became this universal experience. But he was not happy when I first made the suggestion, to the point where on a subsequent visit to Kyoto and the headquarters, the team showed me software that would become WePlay. So a collection of mini games, you know, and those themselves were fun as well, but they didn't have the connective tissue that Wii Sports had with all of the experiences. So then I proceeded to piss Mr. Miyamoto off again by suggesting that we bundle WePlay with the Wii Remote. And he was not happy about that either. But you know, in the end, in the Americas and in Europe, Wii Sports was packed in with the Wii proposition. It was not in Japan, which created a bit of a test market. And you know, it was obvious that in the markets where Wii Sports was packed in, that Wii became much more of a phenomenon. Wii Sports itself became much more of a phenomenon. And we did pack the remote with Wii Play, and I think it became the fifth best-selling piece of software in the history of Wii. So
that's right. A
couple early wins for me and luckily initiatives that worked in the marketplace.
I thought this was such an interesting story to read, because it didn't just highlight your confidence being in this company, which again, you made some pretty big decisions there that have a lasting impact. We now look at Wii Sports sales, and it's one of the few titles to sell more than 80 million units, right? So huge success, and it is in great part because it was a pack-in. So it was a really good strategy to get the maximum amount of people to play this game. But it also opened my eyes a little bit about how Mr. Miyamoto thinks about his place in the business. So he's not just the creator, and he's not just looking to have the maximum amount of people play it. He wants people to purchase the game. He wants it ultimately to benefit the wealth and the success of the company. I thought that was a really cool story.
You know, he has a very sharp business mind. And yep. It's interesting because he would always downplay it. You know, we would be in big meetings and he'd be saying, oh, you know, Reggie-san, you know, you're the branding expert or you're the commercial expert, but, you know, and then put forward a different idea. You know, very sharp commercial mind. But, you know, so many things that people take for granted, you know, pushing for the Americas to launch hardware first had never been done before. But we did it for the first time with the DS, then again with the Wii and so many other platforms that would come later. So, you know, a lot of key things that I pushed for and, you know, fortunately, they worked in the marketplace.
Yeah, and Sorry, go ahead, Kat.
Is it true that Nintendo of America pushed for the name Revolution over the name Wii, since that was the original code name?
You know, we pushed for a number of different names. Revolution certainly was one that we had a lot of heart for. I mean, literally, as I was packing up my office last couple of days while I was at Nintendo of America, I came across some of the old files, branding and naming files for what became the Wii. There were a number of names, and we were concerned about Wii. And I highlight this in the book in terms of it's a name that could easily be made fun of. But you know, NOA took the lead in announcing the name before E3. We wanted all that noise to be done and over with by the time we were unveiling the games and showing the content. And I think that strategy absolutely worked to make sure that, you know, consumers accepted this new system for everything that it was versus just, you know, focusing on the name.
Something that's, I guess this kind of touches on sort of the push and pull relationship that you had with Nintendo, where you had a lot of input on strategic decisions. You had kind of a direct connection with Satoru Iwata, which I'm sure that we'll discuss in just a minute. And it struck me as quite unusual for you to have this much input on everything that was happening, and that Nintendo itself saw this as fairly unusual, but you pushed pretty hard to have this kind of input.
So when I was being recruited, it was clear that the company wanted someone strong-willed. They wanted someone with a variety of experiences in different categories. And they wanted someone who would be confident in articulating a point of view. They probably got more than they bargained for in terms of the way I pushed. But, you know, as you touched on, the reason I was able to be successful was absolutely the relationship that I had, not only with Satoru Iwata, but with Shigeru Miyamoto, with so many of the senior executives at NCL, and the ability early on to build a track record of success and ideas that worked. And make no mistake, I had really strong positive advocacy from the long-term employees that were at Nintendo of America, you know, essentially saying, look, you know, this person is smart. You know, he has a background with video games. He's got a passion for video games. So I think all of that came together in a really powerful mix that enabled me to have a really strong input and a strong legacy of success while I was there.
And you talk a little bit about how the workplace culture at Nintendo of America was very different when you arrived, and that you had to implement a fair number of changes and kind of overhaul the culture there at NOA specifically. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So just to put this in perspective, and I highlight this in one of the stories in my book. When I was being recruited, I'm at a lunch with the head of human resources for Nintendo of America. And again, no job offer in hand. First visit to the NOA headquarters, meeting with the head of HR, and I'm asking about people-oriented initiatives. You know, what do you do from a learning and development standpoint? What do you do from the perspective of enabling people to get exposure to new and different thinking and other ways of upskilling the organization? And his answer to me was, Reggie, we don't do that here. And I'm taken aback. And, you know, and he continues that, you know, we're Japanese parent. Our parent doesn't believe in this. Therefore, we don't implement it. And I literally said, you know, this is not consistent with my beliefs. It is not consistent with what I believe a leader needs to do to develop an organization and to enable it long term to be successful. And I credit Howard Lincoln, you know, prior senior executive with Nintendo of America. At the time, he was chairman for the Mariners. He had already made the transition away from NOA, but he was still part of my interview panel and someone that I continue to have a great relationship with. But Howard said, look, Reggie, you know, as a senior leader at NOA, you're going to be able to implement plans you believe in, including people-oriented plans, and the rest of the organization will watch what you do. And if it's successful, it's going to spread within NOA. And that's exactly what happened. As the head of sales and marketing, I put in place a number of steps focused on the people, focused on the organization. As I became president, I continued to do more and more of that type of activity. You know, I'm proud that, you know, Kat, we didn't revamp the culture. We added elements to the culture that needed to be added. We eliminated elements that needed to be eliminated in order to get a culture that was focused on being proactive, a culture that was focused on generating new and different ideas, a culture focused on developing the next group of leaders. It was a very thoughtful approach that leveraged what was great about what I walked into, but brought in more in order for the organization to be more effective and more successful. And in the end, I judge my legacy that when I retired, as well as the head of HR, who I had that initial lunch with. He and I retired on the same day. And as we retired, we promoted people internally into a variety of different roles versus bringing people from the outside. To me, that was a testament that we had done a great job improving and growing the culture at Nintendo of America.
As,
I know that you, sure you meant, sorry, Kat.
Sorry. I'll give you a sec, Seth. As I'm sure you know, Nintendo's workplace culture has been in the headlines recently because there's been some controversy over Nintendo of America's handling of contractors over the years. And as former head of Nintendo of America and somebody who was kind of an architect of Nintendo of America's current culture, I'm curious if you have a perspective on that.
You know, so Kat, at this point, I'm 3 years retired from Nintendo of America. And I can't comment on what's going on today within the company. What I can say is that while I was there, we routinely hired in as permanent employees, contract employees. We did it repeatedly. And interestingly, if you look at a number of well-known personalities within Nintendo of America, a lot of them started as contract employees, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's always been a positive part of the culture to recruit in the very best of the contract employees into the company. So, you know, I've read the same stories, you know, this division between contract and full-time employee. All I can say is that is not at all the culture that I left as I retired from Nintendo.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned two books, Innovator's Dilemma and Blue Ocean Strategy, as sort of inspiring your career at Nintendo. And I'm curious as to if there's anyone in the management and leadership space now that you're interested in or inspired by, and who might that be, if so?
Sure. So I'm going to do a little correction. In the book, I highlight that we used Innovator's Dilemma and Blue Ocean Strategy as a way to communicate what Nintendo was doing at the time. Meaning, you know, we were well on our path of innovating with the DS and the Wii before those books were out. And so they were much more a communication tool or communication aid versus an inspiration to the work we're doing.
Mm.
In terms of, you know, people in the space that I follow Adam Grant, and I consider Adam to be a friend. He and I met a number of years ago at a conference. We continue to stay in touch. He was gracious to write a very positive recommendation for my book. So I follow his readings, his books quite closely. And ironically, when I first met him, you know, he wanted to do he wanted to use or potentially use Nintendo in some of his writings, and he and I had a conversation about that. It's just, you know, Nintendo doesn't want that type of publicity per se, so it's not something that we wanted to do. But I really value his thinking and his approach on the people-centered leadership space.
You guys definitely popularized the phrase "blue ocean" in internet community circles. I remember after that speech, I saw the term everywhere. Everybody mentioned it, and you know, other game publishers started to mention it as well. That's a really interesting part. Another really interesting part of the history that I wanted to go back to a bit, and you know, I know Kat, you also want to start talking about Iwata maybe after that, but like the Twilight Princess reveal that you teased at, you know, it was a big thing for gamers to see this game, you know, come out of the shadows as kind of like the Zelda game with the presentation that they were hoped for. And like, I think Wind Waker has aged so well and people now go back to it and love the look nowadays, but at the time it wasn't as well received. Can you talk a little bit more about Twilight Princess? Like, when you saw the trailer, did you know you had something big? You obviously had the DS unveiling too, but did you know that this E3 would become legendary?
Well, I knew we had something big in the trailer. Did we believe that the E3 would be legendary? No. And Per, you would understand this. The two E3s prior weren't great. You know, they were pretty low energy events. And so our goal was just we're gonna take things up a notch, right? We're gonna set a new high watermark and continue building from there. That was the goal. And we were fortunate, given all of the great content we had, that we were really able to create something special and meaningful, not only for the Nintendo fans, but I would argue for the entire industry. The first time I saw the trailer was in Nintendo's treehouse on a weekend. I was working hard to learn the business. I was working hard to prepare for E3. Creating and implementing a range of different initiatives to give Nintendo some momentum going into that holiday season when Nintendo DS would be our key volume driver. And so I was invited into the treehouse to see an early cut of that video. And again, I knew the Zelda franchise. I loved the Zelda franchise. I'd played all the games, including Wind Waker. I was quite aware of the early negative commentary about cell shaded Link, and to see that more mature Link, to see that video for the first time, it gave me chills. And I knew we had something that the fans would love, which is why we decided to close that E3 with that powerful video. But afterwards, hearing that in the audience, people were crying and, all of these, emotions that were happening by fans that were watching it live, in that setting, it was tremendously gratifying.
Yeah, the Conan the Barbarian score returning from the Ocarina of Time trailer obviously helped tremendously. But it's one of my favorite things to watch on YouTube is if you can find a video that was shot in the auditorium and you hear the reaction of the crowd to the trailer playing. It's just so amazing.
I just remember downloading the video because this was pre-YouTube and downloading it from IGN.com very excitedly. And then when I was watching, I was going, oh my God, this is what I've been waiting for since Space World 1999 or whatever. So
that's right.
Yeah, it was an amazing trailer.
it was. I mean, that entire E3 was amazing. And in the book, I tell the story, my son, my middle son at the time was in his teens, avid game player, avid visitor to, all of the gaming websites, including at the time, some of the smaller sites that weren't on Nintendo's radar. And I remember him calling me and saying, "Dad, you're famous," and there are all of these memes out there. There are pictures of you with laser beams coming out of your eyes, blowing up the PS2 and the Xbox. And I was shocked. And I gave him the assignment of finding all of these sites and sending me pictures. And it became part of Nintendo's regular process to monitor the internet as our presentation would be happening, and using that as just a fast way to get fan insight as to what's going on out there in the internet.
Yeah, that E3, for people who don't remember all the history, obviously we had Twilight Princess and DS, but we had Metroid Prime 2 was making its first showing. There was a bunch of other big
Resident Evil 4.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So and Minish Cap and just lots of big stuff there.
Yeah, it was
and
phenomenal.
That was also kind of the start of Reggie the mascot, the legend. Were you always intending to be kind of a Nintendo mascot, or did this just kind of happen?
It really just kind of happened. It was, again, I was brought in to lead sales and marketing. I was brought in to drive an aggressiveness. It was added benefit that I knew all the content, and so I could relate with the fans. It was added benefit that I could present and speak well on behalf of the company. it was added benefit that all of this came together in E3 2004, and that we went from there.
Do you have a favorite meme of yourself?
Well, the meme that I use the most currently on my Twitter feed is from Fisamec, right? That video that we did as a pre-E3 announcement. So Reggie as Fisamec taking off the dark glasses and shooting laser beams. That's my favorite. That's my favorite meme.
Your pin wearing strategies have also become very famous, obviously, over the years, and people always read something into you wearing a pin. So even putting on an Earthbound pin would just spiral out of control and turn into all these rumors. And I would be neglecting our NVC fan group if I didn't ask, Reggie, do you think Nintendo will ever release Mother 3 in English, or is that just a game we should just walk away from?
You know, so look, again, I'm 3 years removed. Who knows what they're thinking about now? Well, what I can tell you is that Mr. Iwata and I had a lot of conversations about the Mother series. You know, if you recall, while he was still alive, the Earthbound Beginnings was put on the Virtual Console. So he understood that the fans had a passion for the game and a passion for the series. So I don't know what they're thinking. I have to say, for me personally, versus doing, you know, Mother 3 as it was initially conceived, I think they'd be much better off doing, you know, let me call it a fresh Earthbound, a fresh RPG, leveraging Ness and some of the key characters maybe, but I would want to do something fresh, you know, that speaks to today, that speaks to a current population versus using something that was, you know, gosh, you know, it was finally launched on GBA, what, in 2006? So at this point, you know, the content is a little dated.
I like how you got around answering that, but yeah.
Come on, Pear, you've been around me too many times to know that there are certain things that I just can't answer directly.
That's right.
We've been kind of circling around this, but your relationship with Satoru Iwata, I thought the most illuminating moment in the book was when you said, when Mr. Iwata said, "We're both outsiders." So that seemed to be the common bond that brought you two together.
Yeah, so this was over dinner when I had been promoted to president. And, you know, Mr. Iwata, as well as really all of the Nintendo executives in Kyoto, are famous for really not, you know, not having dinner or outside experiences with employees because they're working until, you know, fairly late in the evening. You know, Mr. Iwata was famous for, you know, being in the office until, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock. They would bring in, you know, a very casual meal from a local convenience store or local restaurant. So he was not one to go out to dinner with other executives. So, you know, it was very special when he invited me out to dinner. And it was over this dinner that, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about our personal backgrounds. You know, we laughed that we both, you know, as 5, 6, 7 year olds had read the family encyclopedia front to back. You know, it was ironic that we had that in our background. And then he did go on to share that, you know, he felt that he was an outsider to NCL. You know, having been at HAL Laboratories, having come in to be head of strategy initially for NCL and then being promoted to be president globally, And we talked about what it's like to be an outsider. One of the other real insights he shared with me was, you know, Reggie, he said, you're very powerful. You know, everyone wants to please you, even our teams in Japan, our teams in Europe. Everyone wants to please you. Everyone listens to what you have to say. So you need to be very thoughtful. You need to make sure that you're hearing other people's perspectives before you push hard on a point of view. So that was very insightful commentary. He and I were incredibly close. And, you know, it really was his passing in 2015, which started my thinking around, you know, what was the legacy that I wanted to leave at Nintendo and how I wanted to make sure that there would be time for me to do other things that I have a passion for, whether it's around education, whether it's around board service, that I would make sure to have time to do those other things, because obviously and unfortunately he did not.
Wow. Well, Reggie, I would love to just sit here and listen to you talk about Nintendo for as many hours as possible, but unfortunately we are out of time. So quickly, where can people get your book?
So Disrupting the Game, From the Bronx to the Top of Nintendo, you know, available at all retailers. The audiobook is narrated by me. So that was a lot of fun. And it has over an hour of bonus content of a conversation that I had with Jeff Keighley, where Jeff and I share a lot of stories. The book is specifically structured that with every story, there is a business lesson or a business principle. I call it the so what. The conversation with Jeff was much more freeform, a bit of, Nintendo behind the scenes types of stories, but available wherever you get your books or audiobooks.
Oh, I was going to say, and that is available on May 5th?
It's available on, let me get this earbud back in my ear. It's available on May 3rd, Tuesday, May 3rd.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I understand some retailers are already breaking street date. I'm getting photos of people who've actually either gotten their book delivered to them or are seeing it up at retail. So this is another thing that would never happen in the video game space. We would spank retailers if they broke street date. But I guess retailers are excited about the book. It's out there in the wild already.
Very nice. Excellent. And then, of course, IGN fans can also see Reggie on our show, Rogue Jam, which episode 2 just launched, where we talk about 3 possible contestants for $100,000 prize for most, what was it, eye-poppingly beautiful game?
Eye-poppingly beautiful.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun shooting the show in LA. Reggie was gracious to come down for an entire week of Rogue Jam, and so look for more episodes on that soon too.
It's fantastic. Per loved working with you on that, and the entire group of judges. Interestingly, I'm spending more and more time with indie type content. You know, not only as part of Rogue Jam, but in the variety of different things that I'm doing within the industry. I'm playing a lot of published content as well, but playing a lot of indie games. And it was a very fun week of activity.
That's awesome, Reggie. It has been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks for all of the great time, the great storytelling.
Thanks for all the memories.
And remember, Nintendo Voice Chat is the only podcast where you can
get the thing.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.